Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we continue reading from the February-March 2026 issue of Guideposts magazine with articles like To Mrs. Bacon with Love. I'll never forget you. To Mrs. Bacon with Love. A student's troubled home life, a teacher's commitment, and a lifelong friendship by Kelly Harrell, Manifee, California. When someone hears I'm going to drive an hour or longer, given the traffic in Southern California, to San Diego to visit Betty Ray Bacon, my eighth grade English teacher, they often say, "That's so sweet of you to look in on your old teacher. She must love seeing you." Mrs. Bacon does love to see me, and I make sure to bring her daffodils or daisies and her favorite gourmet cookies or scones, but our visits are as much for me as they are for her. In fact, she has done far more for me than I could ever do for her. She was brought into my life for a reason. Mrs. Bacon became my favorite teacher on the very first day of eighth grade, not because of her warm smile and gentle voice, but because she gave each student in her class a small notebook and told us we'd be writing in it all year long. Mine had a blue cover. That wonderful thing is that we are each individuals with different ideas and experience, she said to the class. I'm going to have you write about some of yours. All you need to do is write in this journal for 5 to 7 minutes each day. And be honest, that's important. If there's anything you don't want me to read, simply write, "Don't read" at the top, and I'll skip it. Her eyes twinkled. Just don't write that every day or I'll catch on. Write about our lives? My heart beat a little faster at the thought. I loved writing. It was my favorite thing to do in school, but I had so much I kept bottled up inside me, things I knew better than to share with anyone. I was raised in a middle-class family, which to me meant both parents worked and we had enough money to buy new clothes once a year, go camping every summer, and go out to eat once a week. The year before, in seventh grade, I'd learned it also meant that, regardless of how things were at home, you smiled in public. You kept up appearances. My father had loved being a long-haul truck driver most of my life. But in the past year, my parents had begun fighting about his being away from home. Dad's hours got even longer, and he was gone most weekends. Mom got more and more upset. One night in August, a few weeks before I started eighth grade, my parents sat my older brother and me down at the family room table. "We're separating," Mom said. "This doesn't mean we love you less or that we're getting a divorce. We just need a break from each other." There was a long silence. "We're still going camping next week," Dad finally said, as if that made everything better. "Cool," my brother said. He hopped up and walked out of the room. Mom stood. "I should make dinner." Dad stayed at the table for a few minutes before kissing my cheek and leaving the room too. I wanted to cry, but didn't. After all, we were a middle-class family. Dad never actually moved out. He quit his job to save the marriage and keep our family intact. He chose us. But to solve his pain, he drank. Drinking occasionally turned into drinking every day, which turned into drinking all day. The fighting continued, only now it was about his drinking. If my brother was home, he stayed in his room with the door closed, listening to the Smiths. I huddled on the couch in the family room, all alone, the volume on the TV turned up to drown out my parents yelling. I cried myself to sleep at night. It got harder and harder to fake a smile at school the next day. The best part of my day was journaling time in Mrs. Bacon's class. She would give us a prompt, then let us write for 5 to 7 minutes. At the end of the week, she collected our journals and looked them over, then returned them to us. So far, I'd like the topic she asked us to write about. What feelings did the poem we read evoke in me? What did I think of the school dress code? Which character in the novel we were studying did I relate to most and why? In the pages of my journal, I didn't have to watch what I was saying. Not that I was spilling any of my family secrets, but it was a relief to have some place to be the real me. In October, I came down with the flu and had to stay home. My mom picked up my schoolwork for me. I groaned at the pile of assignments and worksheets, but then I saw my blue journal. A sticky note on it read, "Feel better soon. Today's topic, write about a typical day in your home from a mouse's point of view. Mrs. B." That night, I opened my journal and started writing. I imagined myself as a mouse observing life in my house, observing myself. I didn't stop after 7 minutes. I wrote 6 pages front and back about what really went on at home, the truth that I had hidden from everyone, and in some ways, even myself. Maybe I'd been afraid to put everything down on paper because that would mean I couldn't pretend things were okay anymore. I left it all on the page, then I closed my journal and drifted off. It was the first time I hadn't cried myself to sleep in months. Mom brought my completed assignments to my teachers. A few days later, I returned to school. When Mrs. Bacon handed back our journals, there was a sticky note on the cover of mine. Please see me after class. I flipped to the pages I'd filled when I was homesick. At the very end, she'd written, "Oh, Kelly, I'm so sorry." I was horrified. Why hadn't I written, "Don't read" at the top? I waited until all the other kids had left the classroom before going up to Mrs. Bacon's desk. "I read your entry from a mouse's perspective," she said. I stared at the top of her desk. "I'd like to have lunch with you Friday, if that's okay," she said. I looked up. "We could talk if you like," she said. "Or you can talk. I'm a good listener." On Friday, Mrs. Bacon met me in the amphitheater with her bagged lunch. To put me at ease, she told me about her life, how her husband had died unexpectedly a few years earlier, and how hard it was for her still, how she cried sometimes and how other times felt angry. Hearing that, I didn't feel so alone anymore. My fear and shame over what was going on in my family melted away. Mrs. Bacon was so open and honest. I felt safe just being as open and honest with her. And she was right. She was a good listener. Mrs. Bacon was the first person I told when my dad went to visit his sister later that year and came home sober. He didn't explain how he quit drinking. He said only that he had gone to church with my aunt several times a week. I didn't know what to make of it. I was just glad he wasn't drinking, and even more glad when he and Mom reconciled. "You're a very talented writer, Kelly," Mrs. Bacon told me at the end of the school year. "You will accomplish wonderful things, and I want to stay in your life so I can see them." Mrs. Bacon and I have stayed in each other's lives, sharing our struggles and our joys. She inspired me to become an educator and encouraged me in my second career as a writer. Some 20 years after my 8th grade graduation, I dedicated my first novel to her. But the greatest impact she has had on my life, neither of us could have foreseen. In 9th grade, I started going to church with a friend. One day, when the pastor said that God was our safe place, someone we could always turn to in times of trouble, something clicked into place for me, and I became a believer. Looking back, I think the reason I knew I could trust God was because I trusted the person who was my first safe place, my refuge at the hardest time of my young life, my 8th grade English teacher, Betty Ray Bacon. Like I said, she has done far more for me than I could ever do for her. She was put in my life for a reason. Faith and living. Household faith. She felt like she had to take charge of every problem, even plumbing problems in their old home, by Gloria Joyce, Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. Matt and I always knew our 1942 house would need more TLC than a new build, but in the past year alone, we'd had to replace the hot water heater, the oven, and the dishwasher, each of which I'd overseen. Matt helped as much as he could, but he worked long hours. Now a pipe under our upstairs bathtub and shower was leaking through the living room ceiling. Another problem for me to solve. I would have to pick the right plumber for the job and supervise them to make sure the task got done right. With no shower for our family of four to use until it got fixed, I knew I'd better get on it. Still, my first call was to my friend Sarah. "I can't take much more," I said. "God had better send me a miracle or a bucket of money." "Maybe you need to give this problem over to God and ask Him to handle it for you," Sarah said. Her tone was compassionate, not judgmental, but I bristled. Surrender? Why was I hearing this everywhere I turned lately? At a women's conference, in a book another friend had shared, in my pastor's sermons? I wasn't the type to give up. My mom had led our household when I was growing up, as had my grandmother before her. I was the third in a line of strong women named Gloria. Take charge women whose families relied on them to handle everything. Giving up meant failing, and I wasn't about to do that. Seconds after saying goodbye to Sarah, I was on the phone with the big-name plumbing company in town. "We'll send over someone today," the customer service rep said. Perfect, I thought. Early that afternoon, the plumber arrived. "Problem," he said. "I'll have it fixed in a couple hours max." I kept a close eye as he cut a gaping hole in the living room ceiling. A look of dismay came over my face. "I need to call in a more experienced plumber," he said. "See how the old pipe was flattened to squeeze through these ceiling joists? The PVC piping we use nowadays won't work. He'll tell you what we can do, but he won't be able to get here for 2 days. 2 more days without a working shower in the house? With 2 teenage daughters? Urgh. That night, I lay awake making a list of neighbors I could call to ask if we could use their shower. I Googled the definition of surrender on my phone. It was described as more of an act of yielding than an outright failure. I said a quick silent prayer before I fell asleep. "Lord, I surrender the bathroom repair to you." 2 days later, the master plumber had more bad news. "You need to call an HVAC company to move all the ductwork first," he said. "Then we can put in a new pipe. Let's set a date for me to come back in 10 days. 10 days! I flopped down on the sofa. I prayed. I'd surrendered. And what had it gotten me? It seemed my prayers got better results when I spelled out to God what needed to be done, which was pretty much the way I managed everyone else in my life. My younger daughter, Anna, had reminded me of just that the other night when I asked her to do the laundry. "If I don't do exactly how you do it, Mom, you'll say I'm doing it wrong." Ouch. I had to admit, to myself, if not to Anna, it was true, though. That's why I ended up doing everything myself, but it was exhausting. I couldn't do this anymore. "Lord, I surrender," I prayed slowly. "Please show me how to trust this plumbing problem and my other problems to you." Instead of exhaustively researching HVAC companies myself, I called up a neighbor and got his recommendation. "These guys do great work," he said. "You can't go wrong." The HVAC company gave me the earliest available appointment, 8 days away. I'd been hoping to get the master plumber back sooner. I resisted the urge to call a different HVAC company. Surrender, I reminded myself. But I couldn't help wondering, did God understand the urgency here? Those 8 days felt like an eon, though my family was getting to know our neighbors much better from using their showers. It took the HVAC tech 5 minutes to deliver the verdict. "Sorry, ma'am. The duct is bricked in. There's no way it's moving. You have to cut the whole thing out." I excused myself and retreated to the kitchen so he wouldn't see me completely lose it. 10 days after we spotted the leak, I was still at square one, but I was completely out of options. There was nothing more I could do, but, "Lord, I surrender," I prayed. I stepped back into the living room with my checkbook. I told the HVAC tech that the master plumber from the big-name company would be coming again tomorrow. "I'm hoping he can suggest another solution," I said. "Ma'am, forgive me if I'm talking out of turn," he said, "but that big company isn't going to help you. I know a guy. I use him anytime I have an issue with my own older home." He took out a well-worn business card from his wallet and set it on the counter before I saw him out. I was paralyzed by indecision. Call this new guy or keep my appointment with the biggest shop in town? I was already into them for a few $100s. The thought of starting over with a complete unknown made me nervous. When Matt got home from work, I asked his opinion, but he just shrugged. "I have no idea," he said. "You're better at this stuff than I am." I went to bed that night, my mind whirling with uncertainty. Why was this so hard? Wasn't surrendering to God supposed to make life's challenges more manageable? I woke with a start at the sound of a voice. "Call him." It couldn't have been Matt talking. He was sound asleep. I looked at the clock. 3:30 a.m. Just a dream. I rolled over and drifted off again. "Call him." This time the voice was louder, clearer. Now it was 7:30. Wouldn't be able to go back to sleep. I went to the kitchen. There on the counter was the tattered business card the HVAC tech had given me. Rump Plumbing. The hours listed on the card showed they'd already been open for 15 minutes. I picked up my phone. "Hello, I'm not a customer of yours, and I know it's short notice, but I need a plumber, a master," I said and detailed the issue. "Give me a few minutes," the man on the other end said. "I'll call you back." I nervously waited. My phone rang. "I'm going to send my son. He'll be there within the hour." 45 minutes later, a young man showed up. "I'm Brian from Rump Plumbing," he said. He examined the pipes through the hole in my living room ceiling. "Yep, I can fix this. It'll take the day all day, and I'll need to remove a bit more of your drywall. But I'll have your tub and shower up and running before the day is out." Brian sounded confident, but he didn't look that much older than my daughters. He couldn't have been more than a couple of years' experience. Was he really capable of handling such a complex repair? I have an appointment with a master plumber in 2 hours, I said. I'm not canceling it unless you're absolutely sure. I can do this. Trust me. I surrendered. I didn't even hover, supervising Brian's work. Truth be told, though, part of me was afraid to watch. Within 5 hours, the job was complete. Brian removed all the extra fittings and patch jobs that had been installed over the years. He rerouted the drain pipe the right way, rebuilding it back to the sewer stack, clearing a blockage I wasn't even aware of, and the cost was less than the estimate. Tell your dad he has a customer for life, I said as I happily handed him my check. Funny you should say that, Brian said. I was surprised when my dad bumped me off another job to help you today. Most of our customers are lifers. He hasn't taken on a new customer in years, but he has a soft spot for cases like yours. On my own, I never would have picked this small family-run shop, but God had known exactly the help I needed, and not just with the plumbing problem in my old house. Good thing he too has a soft spot for cases like mine. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Here and Hereafter, The Day I Died. Why I'm Grateful for the Accident That Left Me with Chronic Pain, by Andrew Garcia, Thousand Oaks, California. Every day I live in pain. Mostly it's my left arm, the limb I almost lost in a freak accident a few years ago. Now my brain erroneously senses sharp pain there at every moment. I'm numb in several fingers. I can't grip things with my thumb. I used to be the big, strong, go-to-fix-it guy at the church where I'm an executive pastor, the guy who could lift his kids and swing them around without breaking a sweat. I'm not that guy anymore, and yet I give thanks for the accident that forever changed my life. I've come to believe that pain can be a blessing, that loss itself can be an opportunity. Not convinced? Well, let me tell you my story. It happened on my daughter Kara's 6th birthday. It was a cool, fresh Saturday morning at First Baptist, my church in Thousand Oaks, California. My wife Natalie and I were planning on hosting a party for Kara on the church grounds later that afternoon. It had rained the night before, so I woke up early to clear the church patio and walkways of fallen leaves. Actually, it was a fun job, mostly because I got to walk around with a leaf blower backpack. That was the task that was one of the few things I did at church that felt fun in those days. I was 34. I'd been doing ministry of one kind or another for 16 years, ever since I was a counselor at a Christian youth camp the summer after high school. My dad was a pastor too. I guess you could say it was in my blood. I'd been a pastor at First Baptist for 6 years. I handled a lot of the day-to-day, the event planning, the leading the church school. I knew everything there was to know about the nuts and bolts of the church, maybe too much. I never let myself say it out loud, but I'd fallen into a rut. I was fast approaching a danger zone for pastors, burnout. Sometimes work felt more like an office job than a calling. I worked and worked, but did it really make a difference? It's not as if I were bringing in legions of new people to the church. I dreamed of doing big things for God when I was a young man. Now my life seemed to be an endless cycle of worship planning, emails, and meetings. Was that really what God had in mind when I gave my life to Him all those years ago? As I blew through the church campus, the leaf blower drowned out my thoughts. There was something satisfying about watching the leaves as they scattered off the walkways. I came around a corner and turned away from the church, waving the blower. I took a step backward to get an area I'd missed and lost my balance. I unknowingly stepped on a garden edger. The weight of the leaf blower on my back sent me toppling over. I reached my hand towards the church wall to brace myself and crash. My left arm smashed into a full-length, single-pane glass window. I screamed, falling to the ground. My arm was sliced all the way around the elbow joint as it came in contact with the broken shards of glass on the way down. God, help me. There was blood everywhere. I caught sight of my arm and almost passed out. Muscle hung out of my bicep. The bones were still attached, but everything else was severed. I had to stop the bleeding. I had to get help. But I was at the back of the church, far from the street. There was no one else at the church. I'm going to die. I hobbled to my feet, grabbed my injured arm with my right hand, and squeezed. Blood continued shooting out of it. I tried to run toward the parking lot. Maybe I could flag down a car, but suddenly I was dizzy, disoriented. My right hand fell to my side. Blood poured out of my left arm. I reached into my pocket, pulled out my phone, and dialed 911. I cut off my arm. I yelled into the dispatcher and gave her the address for the church. "Can you wrap around a towel to make a tournament?" she said. The world seemed to wobble around me. I saw movement up ahead, a tall, skinny guy with blonde hair. He was running, looking from side to side, as if searching for something, searching for me. He spotted me and stopped, then ran faster in my direction. I felt lightheaded, as if I was about to pass out. The blonde guy reached me. He was young. I couldn't tell how old. I handed him my phone and bent over in confusion. Then I fell to the ground. The world around me began to dim. "Please, God, save me. I need to be here for my wife and kids. I blacked out. The next thing I saw was white, all white, as if I were enveloped in a cloud. I tried to speak, tried to pray, only it was this gauzy place. It felt like I didn't have to, as if my prayers were known before I said them. I tried to make sense of my surroundings. Before I could, a screen filled my vision, a giant wraparound movie screen. In it were millions of small squares, each one alive with images, like photographs. I couldn't see each one, but I knew what they were, moments from my life surrounding me. My attention zeroed on a few of the images, Natalie, Kara, my son Corbin. They were surrounded by something, a kind of light, like halos of love, love for me. Love that I knew came from God. He was the source of all the love I'd given and received in the past 34 years of life. How could I have ever taken one moment for granted? The screen disappeared. The white cloud intensified. I felt a deep peace. The end was near. I sensed myself lying on the pavement of the church parking lot. That blonde guy was kneeling beside me, pressing something against my arm. The paramedics arrived. One of them tied a tourniquet around my head. I heard a giant breath and whoosh. Faces stared down at me. I was back and in incredible pain. The rest of the day unfolded in a series of coincidences. Natalie's mom freaked out when she arrived early to the church with a bunch of balloons, and she called Natalie. I was rushed to the hospital where one of California's most skilled plastic surgeons just happened to be on call. He put my arm back together. Most incredibly, I later discovered that the guy who spotted me at the church had picked up my phone, talked to this dispatcher, and found a towel to hold against my arm. The doctor said if he hadn't done that, I would have died in 30 seconds. He wasn't a member of the congregation. He'd simply wandered onto the church grounds looking for his lost cat. Looking for his lost cat. I went through months of grueling rehabilitation after that day. I eventually regained some function in my left arm. But a few years after the accident, the nerves still didn't work quite right. I've tried all sorts of remedies for the pain. I even had signal blocks implanted in my spine. Nothing seems to help. So why do I give thanks for such a traumatic experience, one that I continue to experience every day? Because of that movie screen and the realization that every moment of life matters, that my job, no matter how seemingly routine, matters. I look forward to going to work now. I even look forward to meetings, mostly. I especially love coming home to my family. I know where the love we share comes from, thanks to the glimpse I received of love's great source. A selection from Walking in Grace 2026. The Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. Psalm 23:1, NLT. My wife's love of exercise hasn't wavered through 35 years of marriage. I have my suspicion she might be a clandestine superhero. "How about a walk?" she said one day. Now, a walk could mean anything from a quick mile around the neighborhood to summiting Everest. As it turned out, it was somewhere in between, a steep up and back climb on a local mountain trail. But it was a nice day and I felt good, maybe even good enough to keep up with Wonder Woman. 2 miles in, I questioned that logic. She waited for me by the side of the trail as I struggled to catch up. "You okay?" "Awesome," I lied. "Are you even breathing hard?" "Don't have a heart attack on me. I'll do my best." 2 more miles had me thinking a heart attack might actually be on the table. At least we had reached the turnaround point. My wife, of course, was waiting again, jogging in place, cape billowing metaphorically in the breeze. The sweat dripping into my eyes made me squint. "Can you feel your legs?" "I can't feel my legs." "Yeah, but you made it." A lot like life. It's so easy to focus on others and compare, to get discouraged. But looking down through the trees at the lake below, I realized it's not the difficulty of the climb that counts, but who you climb with. In my case, a superhero wife and the gracious God who gave her to me and who loves us both every step. "You're right," I said. "I made it." She smiled. "I'll race you down." Heavenly Father, help me keep my eyes on you and never compare. You are not only my guide, but my destination. By Buck Storm. Walking in Grace is our most popular devotional book. To order the 2026 edition, visit guideposts.org/WIG. Write to Guideposts, P.O. Box 5828, Tipton, Iowa, 52772, or call 800-932-2145. It is available in a hardcover edition for $16.95 or a softcover large print edition for $17.95, plus shipping and processing. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.